everybody, and welcome back. Yes, welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic, and I have an irritated eye.
Oh, no.
One of my other occupations, the one that puts food on the table, is I'm a...
Thank you to all of our patrons, by the way. The food might not be on the table, but the rent wouldn't get paid without you, so thank you so much.
Oh, golly, yes. Just like everybody, I have to hustle.
We all do. I have a soap business.
Yeah, there you go. We all got stuff on the side. And one of my primary gigs is as a film projectionist at the New Beverly Cinema. And I worked on a film strip tonight, a 16mm film strip that was so badly rotten and degraded. It smelled like a fish and chip shop.
When
film degrades, it's called vinegar syndrome. When film degrades, it lets off this really, really pungent vinegar like odor. And it was so strong tonight that it started to sting my eyes. And that was hours ago, and my eyes are still stinging from having just to be within proximity of this rotten film reel.
Never let it be said that film archiving isn't a full contact sport.
Oh, goodness, no. You've seen Cinema Paradiso.
Yes, I have. I have. It's a little mawkish, but otherwise...
projectionist got his eyeballs burned out.
Well, yeah, but he was working with silver nitrate without a blast shield. Like, you're not supposed to do that. Anyway, he's Whitney, I'm Bibbs. We've Got Mail. This is the podcast here at Critically Acclaimed, where we invite all of our listeners to write in. Our email address is it's letters at criticallyacclaimed.net. You'd think it's 74 episodes. You think I know this by now. Letters at criticallyacclaimed.net is the email address. It gives me the sillies. We invite you to write in. Ask us questions. Critique our critiques. Ask us for film recommendations.
And take us to task, for goodness sake.
If necessary, yeah, we welcome it. We all wanted to be better people, and I think we'd be hypocritical critics if we weren't able to take a little criticism once in a while, right? So, we're all trying to be our best, and sometimes we need people to point out when we've come up a little short. Mm. So, in any case, we don't like to dilly-dally too much at the beginning of these podcasts. We already did it
too late.
Well, it could be worse. So let's just jump right in. Whitney, who's our first email from?
Our first email is from Moses. Hello, Moses.
Hi, Moses.
Dear Bibbs and Throat Wobbler Mangrove, pronounced Rockmeister McCool.
Nice.
Rockmeister McCool is my name on this show.
Yeah, it's his Dear Abby moniker.
There you go. It's my nom de plume. So once again, enjoyed a week's worth of entertaining and informative podcast from you guys. Thank you very much. Yeah. However... I must point out a slight inaccuracy in a comment you made on your episode of Episode Zero regarding the first two Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan films.
Oh, dear.
Whitney, you said something along the lines of, the very first thing photographed was a horse running, and right after that it was a picture of naked ladies. Sorry if I'm misquoting you, but the spirit is correct.
Yeah.
Being a professional photographer myself, and having studied it in university, I feel I should point out that isn't exactly true. The first known photograph was taken by Nicephore Niepce, from years 1826 to 1827, of the view from his window, see attached. And picture of out of
that's
the
that
window.
The first photograph
it's the
ever?
Very first photograph
let me
ever.
See that, that's
right
awesome.
There. It's all really cool, looks like an Elias Marriage film.
Yeah, it looks really, the grit on that. Wow, you can just see the emulsion, it's gorgeous. Yeah,
remember when they tried to get rid of, like, the grain when they moved to digital technology?
Oh,
everybody said,
Well, they smeared everything. Everything looked like it was, like, a cartoon.
Everybody looked, like, really kind of
pancake-y. No, film grain is part of the image. It adds texture. It's where all the life comes from, yeah.
What you were likely referring to was the works of Edward Muybridge, who famously created a series of photographs of a running horse in 1877 in order to help some millionaires settle a bet as to whether or not all four horses' hooves leave the ground at once during full gallop, see attached. And I've seen those pictures before.
Yeah, I've seen those too.
And yes, indeed, all 4 feet leave the ground at one point.
Yeah, it's weird to think that there was a time when that was like an object of, like, debate.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like, people were freaking out about that. But, like, there was no way to prove it.
Yeah.
There's no way to literally prove it.
There weren't motion cameras yet, But yeah, they had to like take a bunch of still photographs and see if it actually happened. Is believed for centuries by many, while that it does happen, the horse's legs would be extended all the way from the body. The photographs shocked the world by showing that a horse's hooves leave the ground when the legs are all curled under the body. Muybridge continued to make similar studies of people, men and women, walking, running, boxing, fencing, performing cartwheels, etc., while nude. These were considered to be of scientific interest until he started doing studies of women bathing and spanking one another, see attached. Then eyebrows began to raise and his reputation began to be questioned. On the subject of Tarzan, I have an amusing anecdote about his worldwide popularity. I was attending an afternoon weekday prayer at synagogue and, to my shame, had forgotten to silence my phone.
Oh, dear.
My ringtone for text messages is the Tarzan yell. Sure enough, in the middle of the prayer, the jungle yodeling of an ape man blasted forth from my pocket. There was a stunned silence, and then the sound of a 90-year-old Hasidic rabbi chuckling. With agonizing slowness, he stood up, pointed at me from across the room, and croaked, "Johnny Weissmuller!" Have a great day, guys.
That's awesome. Thank you for
and
that.
And here's the women bathing picture.
Oh, classic. She's, yeah,
she's standing in a basin and pouring water over her head.
The expression, Whitney, was we were talking about how the idea that sex and violence in media, or especially visual media, is somehow new. The idea that movies didn't used to have sex and violence in them, and how that was a lie. And Whitney, it's an adage that I had heard. I never actually took it entirely literally, but it goes that the first picture taken was that of a horse. That is often believed to be true, and the second was of a naked woman. And I actually love learning that there's some factual merit to that, but not really.
Not
and
quite.
I love knowing that. Thank you for that. Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me to learn that the French photographer who's photographing out his window also like tried to find nude ladies to photograph like
out
right
his window.
Away.
Yeah. Like, well, just like across the street, you know, like in rear window.
The first photograph was an act of voyeurism.
The first photograph was a murder mystery.
Oh, wouldn't that be a keen?
That would be great.
Like, what would they call that? Historical
fiction.
Yeah, like the historical fiction, but like the murder mystery. I think there's a term for that.
Oh, there
genre,
is a term for like murder mysterizing something. Yeah, I don't know them.
But a murder mystery about the very first photograph would
be
pretty
fun.
Cool.
Yeah, it'd be cool. And that's why we don't see that first photograph anymore. It got burned.
That's right.
The
first one. We don't know about
like
that.
Everyone's
one.
Like, I have this photograph. What the fuck is a photograph? How do you know?
This new technology proves he did it.
That's actually not a bad idea. If anyone, okay, we just gave that to the world. If anyone writes that, you have to name some characters after us, and we want to thank you if it turns into a movie.
I want to be a bumbling cop that the bad guy kills partway through the movie.
Nice. I want to be a funny coroner.
Oh, the wisecracking pathologist.
I want to be the wisecracking pathologist. If there's a movie I want to be in, I want to be the coroner.
Yeah.
That's the best part. That's the best role in any movie.
It's such a cliche, but I always love it when the show turns up in a movie.
The only better role in a movie is the guy in the Air Bud movies who pulls out a clipboard and says, "Ain't no rule says a dog can't fill in sport here. Play volleyball, play baseball."
And somebody in a Godzilla suit.
Okay, well, goes without saying. Yeah. I meant with lines. You know they overdub those guys.
No, they speak their own Godzilla.
They speak their own Godzilla. They don't take weeks-long courses. They don't have pre-recorded Godzilla noise. Okay, fine.
Our next letter comes from Fab. Hello, Fab.
Hi, Fab.
Hello, Bibbs and Senor McCool. Great iron list of the best musicals ever. Can't wait to watch The Tune. I recommended The Tune.
You did.
A Bill Plimpton movie.
Yeah.
My top musicals, in no particular order, are Hedwig and the Angry Inch, one of my favorite LGBT movies. We didn't mention it, and that is our fault. That is a remiss.
It would have at least made my honorable mentions. Like, it's pretty damn amazing, honestly. Yeah.
The Ruttles, All You Need Is Cash. Hilarious parody of the Beatles. I worry this gem could fall into obscurity. Yeah, the Ruttles aren't talked about stateside too much.
It used to be. There was a brief period in the 90s when they were pretty well known, and like the album sold pretty good and was on TV fairly often. But yeah, the Ruttles were this kind of This Is Spinal Tap, but for a fake version of the Beatles. The music was pretty good, actually. They did a good job.
Eric Idle was one of the Ruttles. I remember a really funny gag where this is the It's a fake documentary, and the documentarian was standing in front of the stadium. He says, this is Shea Stadium, named after that famous leader, Shea Stadium. I thought that was... That's a gag that stuck with me.
That's pretty funny.
Number three, Hecho en México, a documentary about Mexico's music and heritage. Even though this is a documentary, I think it belongs on the list because of how the music is woven into the dialogue and flow of the film. I don't know Hecho en
México. I don't know that one. Yeah. I'll check that out sometime.
Singing in the Rain.
Yep.
Singing in the Rain. Across the Universe, in addition to the music, you got to love the production design. We posited that it's... Like, I can't tell if that's, like, one of the greatest movies ever made or one of the worst. And it can
really
be
polarizing.
And it can be both. So,
yeah, kind of simultaneous. There are people who think, and I know a lot of, like, hardcore Beatles fans, of which I am also a hardcore Beatles fan, but I know a lot of hardcore Beatles fans who reject Across the Universe because it's a Beatles movie without the Beatles in it.
Yeah.
And it's a bunch of covers, and they're really bending over backwards until, you know, their bones break. To try to, like, find a way to weave a narrative out of every single Beatles hit, like, they could possibly get in there. Like, we can't leave anything out. We must find a place for it. And some of them work better than others. But for me, what I think is kind of fun about it is that it posits that even without the Beatles themselves, their music spoke to a generation and, like, was actually, like, indicative of many facets of life in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And as a result, there's something kind of pure about it, almost death of the author kind of appreciation of Beatles music. And I think it's interesting. I think it's an interesting movie. I don't think I mentioned it in my honorable mentions. I probably should have also as well. Mm-hmm. But and it is a hell of, and of course it's Julie Taymor, so it's an impeccably designed motion picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number six, Rock and Roll High School.
Yay.
Number seven, Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story, which I haven't seen.
I know a lot of people who sing the praises of this movie and call it one of the best comedies of the century.
Yeah.
I have also not seen it. I'm not avoiding it. For some reason, it just never comes up.
Never hasn't drifted into our field of vision.
I will see that movie at some point, and it's probably going to, based on the number of people and who love it and the praise that they sing of it, I'm probably going to go, why the hell didn't I watch this earlier?
Number eight is Dreamgirls.
Mm.
Number nine is Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. Which, does that count as a musical? I guess so.
I guess it's kind of a musical.
I mean, it's got Sweet Talk and Candyman. That'll stick in your head. But yeah, it's about musicians.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an awesome film. Don't get me wrong.
Like,
if you want to start splitting hairs over genre, I suppose it could be a musical.
I would think that it probably doesn't have quite enough music to be a musical, but I also wouldn't fight you on it. So that's why I wouldn't even have considered it.
Yeah. Well, it is My Happening, and it freaks me out. And number 10 is Tenacious D and the Pick of Destiny.
Which is
fun for kind of how cheap and silly it is, I think.
I feel like that's better music than it is a movie. Like, the music is really, really good. All the classic bits are in there. But I think the movie itself is a little... It even almost seems shabbier than the show did to me. But what I realized that I don't think I mentioned, and I'm actually mad at myself if I forgot to mention this, is Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stop.
Oh, God. Yeah, we didn't mention that
one. We didn't mention either. That one. And in retrospect, it should have been in my top 10.
Yeah,
I really do think I dropped the ball on that one in particular. That...
One of the funniest movies of the decade.
One of the funniest movies of the century. Mm. One of the funniest movies, like, in a long, long time. The music is really catchy, and it's really, really funny. The movie works. It's very, very silly, but it also has some heart to it. And, like, it's just fucking
it's just
great.
Spot on. It
and
really
nobody
is.
Cared when it came out. There was some, there was, like, some critics loved it.
Hard,
some critics loved it, but, like, nobody watched it. And that's a fucking crime. Mm. It is such a good motion picture. I hope people see this movie more. Anyway, I just love it. But like,
please see Pop Star. If you haven't seen Pop Star.
It's so funny. But that's a great list.
Oh, well, and there's some honorable mentions. Yep. Tommy, and this is Spinal Tap. Tommy's a fascinating beast, isn't it? You've seen Tommy,
I've never seen all of Tommy.
Oh, okay.
I admire Tommy. I don't know if I like
Even
Tommy.
If you've seen Tommy, it feels like you haven't seen all of Tommy. Like, there's so much information, your brain just stops absorbing it after a while.
Yeah. Spinal Tap, I have a weird relationship with Spinal Tap. I actually like the second Spinal Tap album more than I like the first Spinal Tap movie.
Okay.
But it's a really, really funny movie. I think, I don't know, there's so many, like, great classic bits in there, but there's also a whole lot in the middle that just kind of vapor. There's, like, 10 bits that I remember very, very clearly, and then there's also the rest of the film.
Well, I remember watching this as Spinal Tap when I was younger. I was, like, maybe, like, 11 or 12 years old, and I didn't get the joke yet. Because I had seen some music documentaries, and to my eye, it was indistinguishable from a real music documentary.
Yeah.
But I was assured it was a comedy, but I didn't see any of the jokes. Weird. I just saw sort of a straight up music documentary.
One of the great controversies I've ever had in any job I have ever had, and this is something where you cannot get three people to agree on this. You're working at a video store.
Uh-huh.
Spinal Tap. Does it go under S or T? It
goes under T. The title of the film is This is Spinal Tap.
I agree, but most people call it Spinal Tap. Would they not look for it under S? That was the argument.
Well, it doesn't matter where they're looking. You file it correctly, damn
it. But
then
they can't find Spinal Tap, and then we spend
all... Then they ask for
every
you.
Single... But then we constantly have to show them where Spinal Tap is. Wouldn't it be easier if we just put it under S? I agree with you. I also put it under T.
Yeah, no.
But I'm just saying, I've run into this argument every video store I ever worked at, every video store I've ever visited. Mm. If it comes up, it's a point of contention. Everyone goes, not this again.
I actually got into, not a row, but just had a little bit of a snit with... a fellow archivist of mine, over where you would file the Jurassic Park sequel.
Now, the Lost World Jurassic Park?
Yeah, because the title of the film is, it would be Lost World colon Jurassic Park comma the.
Yeah, it's not a subtitle, it's a supra title.
Right.
S-U-P-R-A. Mm. And that's actually something that they're often used interchangeably, but technically, I actually did a schmodown where I was asked the question, what Stephen King movie had a 1990s sequel with the subtitle The Rage, to which I replied, Carrie.
Mm.
But after I answered, I was like, technically, though, that's a supra title because it's The Rage colon Carrie 2.
Yeah.
Not Carrie 2, The Rage. And they were like, do you want the points or don't you? And I'm like, okay, I want the points. I want the points. I just wanted to make it clear. This is the difference between a subtitle and a supra title. Mm. Anyway. So the question is, do you follow... What I would do is... And this is one of those ones where ideally you put everything in alphabetical order, just simpler. Mm. But I think you put everything in a franchise together.
Okay.
So you put Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, Army of Darkness, they're all together.
Same with James Bond.
Yeah.
They all have different titles, but you can sort of hang a little extra placard within a different
section. I would put James Bond as a little...
Here's all the James Bond movies together, so you don't have to go all over the store.
Here's what you do. You file them under 007. They're right at the top.
Oh, there you go.
They're under numbers, is before the letter A. Boom, 007 gets its own little section. However, sometimes you're working for... This isn't a thing anymore, obviously, but if you're working for a big corporate entity like Blockbuster or Hollywood Video, you had no choice. And if their decision of where something goes makes no sense, you're not allowed to change it.
Mm.
Stupid. Anyway, but that's a great list. Thank you for sending that in. And I'm embarrassed at some of the ones you mentioned that we forgot.
Yeah, that's on us.
Yep.
It's all on us.
Yep, we are imperfect in the extreme. What's our next letter?
Here's a letter from Christopher. Hello, Christopher.
Hi, Christopher.
Good day, gentlemen. I just recently listened to your latest letters episode where a guy from British Columbia wrote in about the ethics of piracy, stating that he will be pirating Godzilla vs. Kong, among other films, because HBO Max, Peacock, and such aren't available in Canada. I wanted to write in because I am also from British Columbia.
Okay.
Hello from Victoria.
Hello.
And what that listener failed to point out is that while no HBO Max, Peacock, Hulu, and a handful of others aren't available up here, their exclusive content is almost always available to watch legally through other means.
Ah.
Most Hulu content usually either goes to our version of Amazon Prime Video or our Canadian exclusive streaming service, Crave. Crave in particular has a licensing deal with HBO that almost all HBO content ends up day and date with Crave and the Crave Plus HBO package, which is an additional $10 a month, costing $20 total.
Okay.
I'm guessing that's Canadian dollars.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
This was the case with Zack Snyder's Justice League, among others. Godzilla vs. Kong is not available on Crave, however, but it is available via premium VOD at $30, as was Wonder Woman. Mm. I felt this was worth pointing out because, in my mind, piracy isn't absolutely necessary in this case. To end this letter with an actual question, do you suppose that once the pandemic is over and the novelty of movie theaters being open again is back, will people start to long for the days of being able to watch big budget new releases day and date from their home? Thanks for all the great work you do, Christopher.
I think it was the most recent we've got mail before this. We were asked a question about movie piracy and whether if a movie is unavailable to you, it is still moral or ethical to pirate it, since otherwise you wouldn't be able to get it at all. And there's... I used to be an absolutist about this, but I honestly think that there's a lot of gray areas in there. Mm. But I think what it boils down to is if you can get it legally, you should get it legally.
Yeah.
And if you can't get it legally at all, then it's understandable. But when the opportunity comes to get it legally, you should get it legally. Mm-hmm. Because people do deserve to be paid for their work. Sounds like there were some nuances about Canadian streaming that we did not understand, and we would have incorporated that into our argument. Thank you for clarifying that. We really appreciate it. Secondly, will we be nostalgic for pandemic streaming? And, you know, it's really difficult to say exactly how this is going to all shake out when all is said and done. You know, the vaccines are increasingly available. It's looking like a significant portion of the population will be vaccinated. It depends on your country, but in America, there's a significant amount of the country will be vaccinated within a few months. And then life, I don't think life will return to normal, but life will resume some elements of normalcy. I think a lot of people are still going to be pretty gung-shy about, you know, big public spaces full of crowds.
Yeah.
I think there's still going to be people who will sort of reflexively social distance. I'm sure I'm going to be one of them. Mask usage, I suspect, will be, I mean, more optional, but I think people are still going to do it more often. Yeah, one of the big industries that shifted dramatically was movie distribution, because all the theaters closed down, and a lot of studios, most notably Warner Brothers, which decided that in 2021, all of their major releases would premiere day and date on HBO Max for no additional cost. And also premiere in theaters. And a lot of people were just like, wow, that seems like it's jumping the gun. And, oh man, when theaters open, they are not going to do... Godzilla vs. Kong did fine in theaters. Actually, it's doing pretty good. Like, it's not as good as it probably would have done before. But it's doing okay. And well, for me, I think that means that this actually might be a model that works going forward. And we might not say goodbye to this altogether.
No. The old way is gone. I'm convinced that the old way is gone. We're not going to be able to get back to what we had, especially because a lot of the theaters are gone now.
Yeah.
A lot of them just closed. Yeah. We have fewer screens now than we had before. So we're definitely not going back in anything we had. And indeed, as of this recording, we were learned just yesterday that Pacific Theaters and Arclight Theaters are out of business.
Yeah.
They're not going to be reopening. So that's, you know,
LA. That's everywhere.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're not...
Well, those are... Arclight, I think, is largely Los Angeles only.
But I think Pacific is larger than that, right?
Yeah, I think Pacific is a nationwide.
That's a big deal, especially for people in LA. The Arclight is considered kind of a local institution. There are multiple Arclights, but when people say the Arclight, they mean the one in Hollywood. Because that's the one that has the Cinerama Dome, which is this giant, historically significant movie theater.
It was built in the 60s.
Yeah, it's a mad world premiered there.
It's a gigantic dome, and it's 70 capable, so you can see gorgeous
it's a great
movies
movie
on a gigantic
theater.
Screen.
It's a great movie theater, and I hope it doesn't go away. But yeah, they just announced that they're not coming back. Now, it's been argued that the Cinerama Dome in particular is a significant enough historical landmark that someone else will buy that up. Netflix will buy that, or Amazon will buy that, or Disney will buy that.
Disney may buy it, but you'll notice Netflix, Amazon, and Disney. Disney just tripled down on their streaming platform.
Yeah, you're right. Probably
they made a lot of these big press announcements. Yeah, we're going to keep on exploring Star Wars. We have 18 more Star Wars shows and movies in the works now, and they're all going to be on Disney Plus. It's all that's where they're going to be putting the bulk of their money.
Disney is mostly they've pretty much flat out said they're not that interested in theatrical anymore.
Yeah,
some of the movies are big enough that they'll do it, but I don't think they care as much as people at home might think.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so we're moving into this period where I think it's going to be this hybrid sort of releasing where things are going to be available in theaters, but a lot of the more mainstream stuff will also be available almost immediately, or maybe with a few weeks padding between the theatrical release and the streaming release.
Or it will be the thing that Disney does, which is we'll release them simultaneously, but at home you're going to pay more.
Yeah.
Which honestly, if you've got five kids or something like that, that's a bargain. But if you're only one person paying $30 to see a Disney movie, doesn't make financial sense, does it?
I'd be interested to see if they do that with a film they start production on now. Because the ones they've done that for so far were already in the can. And they kind of had to just admit that they need to make some kind of money on these things. Otherwise, they'll take a bath.
Well, they're not releasing their numbers, though. They won't tell us exactly how much Mulan made. You know, they won't tell us exactly how much Raya made.
And because of the way streaming works, they don't have to. Netflix set that precedent.
They don't have to answer to theater owners and say, here's how much these movies made. They don't actually have to. They have no obligation. They're vertically. With streaming services, we're getting into a lot of weeds here, but like with streaming services, studios are once again vertically integrated. Not every studio has their own streaming service, but the big ones mostly do. Vertical integration is what happens when you control the means of production and the means of distribution, and the means in between mostly. So basically means you don't have to answer to anyone to make and deliver your product. In this case, it's art, which some might argue is not a product, but to a corporation it is. So back when that was, vertical integration was the way of the land for a long, long time. Movie studios either owned theaters or had ironclad contracts with various theaters saying, you will take this much of our products. You will take these big A-level movies you would have wanted, and you also take the movies that we're not proud of and won't make you any money, but you won't get the good movies unless you take those. In the 1940s, there was a Supreme Court case, which was, I think, the United States versus Paramount.
Yeah.
And
Paramount decision.
The Paramount decision, the Supreme Court ruled that vertical integration, at least when it comes to cinema, is unconstitutional because it's a form of monopoly. You're monopolizing the content. The theater owners no longer have any say in how they are running their business. So after that, theater owners were now free to only take the movies that they wanted, and also show movies from multiple different studios, movies from overseas, movies from independent filmmakers. And that saw a big rise in international cinema, independent filmmakers. Also, movie studios suddenly had to be a little bit more careful about the movies that they made because they had to make something that movie theaters would actually want to distribute and not just anything they happened to produce. But now with streaming services, there's no movie theaters to answer to anymore. So they can do whatever they want, and they don't have to tell you how they're doing.
Well, and if the studios own their own streaming services, they don't have to vet it through some tertiary company.
Exactly. So it's all on them. They can tell you. They can tell you it's making money. They can tell you it's not. They can do whatever they want to do. Basically, it's the Wild West out there. And yeah, I'm still not sure that's constitutional, but because there's a problem with there's a lot of self-dealing involved in that. There was a court case a couple of years ago between the producers of Bones and 20th Century Fox, where 20th Century Fox, which owned the streaming service Hulu, said, hey, here's Bones. It makes a fortune in advertising. It's a big, popular show. Well, why don't we just put that on Hulu, and then Hulu will be more popular because it has Bones on it. The producers had a contract saying that when Bones was available for distribution, reruns, home video, etc., that the studio had a responsibility to try to find the best financial deal. Instead, they found the deal that benefited themselves. And indeed, apparently, there was a contract signed between Fox and Hulu in which the people from Fox and the people from Hulu who signed it were the same people. It was literally self-dealing.
Yeah.
And it cost the makers of Bones a lot of money, and they won that lawsuit. So there's a precedent for that. So why?
But the law has now changed, so it's a little different.
It's a little different, but who knows? So I think we're going to run into some issues with this, and I'm curious to see how far people are willing to push some of these things, and we'll see how far VOD can really go in this direction. But I do agree that I think the genie's out of the bottle now. I think we're just going to find some version. Different studios might do it a little differently, but the big movies, there's not going to be a gigantic release window. We're going to have more options. And in a lot of cases, this is actually a good thing. I know a lot of people who have disabilities are actually very glad that they can get to see movies. Because a lot of movie theaters are not made for people with disabilities. They're just not. They do a very, very poor job of it.
Just people who live in cities that don't have movie theaters.
Exactly.
A lot of these screens are closing down. There was a little bit of a panic when Steven Soderbergh released his film Bubble. Bubble is actually a historically significant film because it was released on home video in theaters and on streaming services, mm-hmm. such as they were back in the early 2000s.
Yeah, same day.
All simultaneously. The first like you one could to do download that. It on iTunes that day. And that was a novelty at the time.
Yeah. No, granted, it wasn't a big blockbuster. It was an independent film, but it is
little,
noteworthy.
Little tiny independent film, and everyone was a little bit afraid that Steven Soderbergh was revealing that theaters could be bypassed. Well, you know what? Now they are.
Well, they can.
And the future I see is there's going to be repertory houses. There's going to be little independent houses. I think those are always going to survive through the cracks. They're not going to be gigantic business.
No. But you can keep a theater alive in a community that supports that theater.
Exactly.
That should be possible, yeah.
But I think what we're looking at is a future where the studios do own the theaters again.
Yeah.
And the biggest studios will just be distributing their own product. So if you want to see the Disney film, you go to the Disney theater.
Yeah.
You want to see the Netflix film, you go to the Netflix theater.
I also agree with this is going to happen.
Yeah, this is
it's sooner than later.
The idea of the what you and I grew up with was the idea of the multiplex. You go to one theater, they have 16 screens, and you can see several movies there.
From different studios.
From all over the place.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that
we're going to see a lot
less. Is going to start to wither pretty quickly.
Yeah, but we'll find out. I think we're going to really see how things will shake out like kind of by the end of the year. Because I think some theaters are going to try to hang on, see how big the business can get again. Yeah. But it's also possible that
Godzilla did well, but it was the only one.
True. Well, the thing is that it made more money than people expected. It also probably didn't make as much money as it would have 3 years ago. So it's hard to say. We're going to be watching closely how this shakes out. And honestly, it might not be clear exactly how it's going to shake out for years. Because it's a weird system.
It's a weird system, and it's moving quickly, and the technology is changing so much. And everybody's trying to predict what the future will be. But yeah, Disney and Warner Brothers have put all of their money on streaming.
Yeah.
That's where it's going to go for those two big companies.
We might revere the theatrical experience. Many of the filmmakers might reveal the theatrical experience. There might even be some people at those corporations that revere the theatrical experience. Overall, they care about money. And a lot of people are like, those movies make billions of dollars. Certain movies make billions of dollars. The majority of the movies that a studio makes does not. So you also have to factor in the possibility that most people only see a handful of movies in a theater every year. They see most of their movies at home. So the question the studios are asking themselves is it really worth gambling on having all of these movies we spent so much money on making over $1 billion to justify the amount that we spent on them? Or is it worth putting out just enough premium content, I'm using the word the way they would, on our streaming services that instead of paying like $15 a ticket to see three of our movies a year, people are spending $15 every month for 12 months out of the year. They make more money that way. So it's a little cynical to think of it that way, but again, to them it's a business. It's what it's like. Anyway.
They'll chase the dollar, and sadly, it's...
Hollywood's
not a democracy.
We got off on a rant here because it's a long, complicated topic, but the original question was, will we be nostalgic for day-and-date VOD? And I think our answer is, I don't think it's going to go anywhere, or it might not overtake things right away, but I think we're not going to completely move away from it. Next letter?
Yeah, we'll see. Next letter comes from Jeremy. Hello, Mr. Bibiani and Mr. McCool. I've been wondering how to ask this question for some time, and since you may have some insight into the technology, to help me figure out, I would try. I remember watching some Mystery Science Theater 3000 episodes and noticed that sometimes they seemed rather clear in their definition. I noticed it more with Overdrawn at the Memory Bank. I kept thinking it was a strangely good resolution for a B-movie. Then I watched the newest Little Women at my friend's place on a brand new high-definition TV, and I felt like the resolution was different from what I had seen in the theater, and it sort of distracted me, and I couldn't enjoy the movie as much as I had in the theater. Then my TV of 10-plus years decided to die on me, and I went out to buy a new one and ended up getting a 4K TV, because it seems like that's all I could find. But now, whatever I watch, no matter how old the movie is, for example, I watched Saturday Night Fever recently, the picture looks like Overdrawn at the Memory Bank, or an early 2010 episode of Doctor Who, and I'm rather distracted by the clarity.
Okay, you got motion smoothing.
I feel like I'm missing a veneer of the less defined pictures offered me... to allow me to engage in the movie. I was wondering if you were able to explain what is going on and if you or anyone you know has had similar feelings that I have. I feel like things have gotten a little too clear for my likings. Anyway, if you'd like to read my letter, thank you so much. And I greatly appreciate all the shows you gentlemen offer. Hope you're doing well. Give Luca a scratch behind the ear for me. Sincerely yours, Jeremy.
I will definitely give Luca a scratch behind the ear for you, Jeremy. Thank you for your question. And it's a great question. And it's a question I think we forgot to bring up more often because when people started moving to widescreen TVs and high definition and DVD and Blu-ray, this topic came up a lot, and then we got a little slack on it. But here's the gist of it. Movies and let me start again. TVs have a variety of settings in terms of their visual settings, their brightness, their tint, their sharpness in a lot of cases. And when you get them out of the box, like when you just open them up, most televisions are set for a very particular mode of image that is designed to look good in a store. Like in really, really bright fluorescent lighting, you're walking by and you're supposed to capture the eye making a wow. However, this particular look is not the way the original filmmakers intended. It's actually got a lot of it's boosted. The brightness is probably boosted, and it's probably got something that is often called motion smoothing, which basically gives every piece of the image this, you said to yourself, like an early episode of Doctor Who, it makes it look like it has a higher frame rate, and it makes it look a little uncomfortably clear. Higher frame rates, the way they work is most movies that we see are 24 frames per second. And we've grown accustomed to 24 frames per second as just 24 images. You move them fast enough, 24 per second, it looks like movement. If you add a bunch of frames to that, you're seeing so much more image between that one second of time that it's more imagery than our brain is used to processing, and it looks weird to most people.
And 24 frames per second, from what I remember from college, when I was studying these things, was the minimum number of frames that was required on a film strip that still looked like natural movement.
Yeah.
They were just being economical. You know, they don't want to put in too many, because they could have shot 60 frames per second back in the silent era, but that was too much film. That's an actual physical film stock.
Film takes up actual physical space, and there's only so much you could fit into a magazine at the time to plug into the camera.
And they figured out that somewhere between 22 and 26 was good enough for the human eye.
Yeah.
A human eye can process more than that, but that's as much as they were willing to give up. And the actual frame rate you saw in the silent era was variable depending on how fast. Sometimes they were hand cranked and they would be run at different speeds.
Yeah, because it didn't really matter. But once you added synchronized sound, it had to be a consistent frame rate. Otherwise, the sound would go out of sync. So it needed to be 24 frames per second. It couldn't be 23 frames 1 second, 26 frames the next second. That was the sound wouldn't work that way.
And that's film and that's high definition video.
Yeah. However, some European markets use a video system called PAL, which is closer to 30 frames per second.
PAL is actually only 25.
Is it only 25? Yeah. I thought it was a little more than that. Well, regardless, it's just a little bit more, and the human eye can kind of notice it looks a little different.
And NTSC video is 30 frames per second.
That must be what I'm thinking.
And it's also HD is 30.
Yeah.
And there's
and some video games have higher frame rate as well.
Yeah. But, there's HD. Oh, you know what? There actually is a PAL that runs super fast.
Like, that's what I'm thinking. Super PAL?
It's like a Super PAL, and that's like 50 frames per second.
Well, in any case, motion smoothing is a setting that a lot of TVs have that creates this, like, ultra crystal clear, the semblance of having an ultra high frame rate.
What it does is it takes the image, you know, think of the frame rate and, like, the tiny change in between the two different frames.
Yeah. Well, so let's say your hand is off to the side and now like you're waving. So the next frame it would be up.
Up a little bit. Now in 24 frames per second there wouldn't be anything in between those. You just have those two frames.
Yeah.
But if all of a sudden you're watching a film that can TV that can do like 60 frames per second.
Yeah.
There's not going to be a lot of like little bits of information in between those two frames, and they're using these smart artificial intelligence technologies to figure out what would go in there, yeah, and artificially creating a digital image to smooth those two frames together.
Now, neither Whitney or I are like tech guys. There's probably more elaborate terminology we can use to describe this, and probably we could be describing this a little bit more accurately than we are, but that's the gist of it. Here's what it boils down to, and this is what I recommend to every single person who has a high-definition TV, which is most people now. If you haven't already, look online. You can Google it. Find your exact model TV. You know, you can probably find it on the television itself or on the back of it, or maybe if you have your original receipt or whatever. Find your exact model TV, and then look for... I'm struggling to think of the exact wordage because it's been a while since I bought a new TV, but you should be able to Google the brand of your TV and like the preferred video specs. And what I have found is that every time I've bought a new TV, I can go online to some AV forum or really good high-end like home video website, and they will take all the major brands and they will say, okay, if you want to approximate the way a filmmaker actually intended, this is basically like the DVD you bought, the Blu-ray you're watching, the streaming service you're watching. If you want to see this the way that it's intended to look, your settings should be here. Your brightness should be at, I don't know, 47. Your tint should be at 52. Your so on and so forth. And that will vary from TV to TV. And
that's what that's what the color bars are for.
Exactly. And when in doubt, turn off motion smoothing. I have heard some horror stories about TVs where that cannot be turned off. Oof. I refuse to believe that we live in a world where that's allowed. I hope that's not the case, but in any case, go to your, open your menu on your TV. You should be able to adjust the settings. You can just adjust them until they look right to you, but if you want them to be exact, if you want to make sure that like you're watching Citizen Kane the way Orson Welles intended, or watching Godfather the way Coppola intended, there is information online, generally speaking, per TV or per model, to get your settings so that they look right. Yeah. And they will probably be a little jarring at first. But you'll get used to it.
What I love about these discussions is there is always going to be assholes like us who are sticklers for visual integrity.
Sure.
We want to be able to see a film in a different technology if we're not going to be seeing it on a big screen to kind of approximate what it originally looked like. And I've noticed the Criterion Collection has been really, really good about maintaining like film grain and trying to maintain a lot of the visual texture of an original 35 millimeter film print or even 16 millimeter film print. As the technology changes, sticklers like us have to keep like they keep us on our toes.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we invented motion smoothing. Wait, like, no, we didn't agree to that.
We didn't ask for that. Who asked for this?
And some people are really keen on that. They actually like the way motion smoothing looks. Yeah. A lot of these TV shows, especially if you watch just like a baking show, they got these really super high definition cameras now are presented at like 60 frames per second.
But that's not the same as motion smoothing.
No, it's not. But when you pop in an old movie that runs at 24 frames a second, to a lot of people, that looks a little weird. So they're actually going to want that new kind of smoothing technology.
Okay. They want, you're looking for visual consistency rather than visual accuracy.
Exactly.
Okay. And, I can see that. I disagree with that, but I can see that. Yeah.
And indeed, it's the waters are being muddied by certain filmmakers who are really keen on the new technologies. Peter Jackson, for instance, he and Ang Lee have been really trying to push high frame rate.
Yeah. 48 frames per second or more.
48 or more. I think, wasn't one of the Hobbit movies done at like 128 frames a second?
Was it really that much?
Or am I thinking of, what's his name? Billy Long's
Long Halftime Walk? I think Lynn's Long Halftime Walk.
That was an Ang Lee film. It was shot in this like super high frame rate. They insist that this is the way of the future. And those two filmmakers. Did you see the Peter Jackson documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old?
No.
Yeah. Peter Jackson made a documentary about World War I soldiers. He found some old footage, and rather than just restore it so you could see what it looks like, he used like that motion blurring technology to make it look more like a modern film. So the motion was a lot smoother. He tried to make it look more natural. He colorized it.
Yeah.
And he hired like lip reading experts to figure out what some of the people were saying, and then hired actors to dub in the voices.
So that sounds like an interesting experiment.
It's a tech experiment, but at the same time, you know, for people like us who are sticklers for the, sort of the way film looked, it is kind of erasing how we view those things and how they were viewed at the time and how people behaved in front of a camera. Everybody has a camera now, so they behave a little bit differently. And we can't pretend that, you know, back during World War One, that people were behaving that way.
True. Yeah, yeah. People behaved very differently. Yeah, that sounds true. So in any case, I hope this explains it. I know it got a little rambly in the middle there, but basically the gist. Most TVs out of the box have these very specific factory presets that are not designed to replicate the theatrical experience of watching a movie or the specific intentions of any filmmaker in terms of how they wanted their movie to look in terms of brightness, motion smoothing, etc. What you're specifically describing sounds like you're really distracted by motion smoothing, so go into your menu, turn that off. It might be called something a little different depending on your brand. You should be able to look that up pretty easily. But generally speaking, go to some AV side, look up your exact brand of television. There should be someone out there who has put together the ideal settings in order to approximate exactly what you would see in a theater. And I highly recommend doing that. But for the love of God, if you can, I highly recommend turning motion smoothing off. Even if you do think it's kind of cool, if it's really not what filmmakers intended.
Yeah.
It's really, really not. And again, you can watch a movie any way you want. But if you care about the way filmmakers intended it to look, which, again, they worked their asses off to make it look exactly that way. So I highly recommend checking the movie out in that fashion, regardless of screen size, at least to get the color timing right. So anyway, hopefully that clears it up. Thank you.
Here's a letter from Jacob.
Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Jacob. Greetings from the North Country. The North Country? Iceland? It's,
Wait
a minute. I don't know. Well, there are many countries north of, this
you
one.
You know what? We're just going to move on. I apologize for winning.
Don't you ever apologize for me. I can embarrass myself on my own.
And you do.
I recently was having a conversation about The Twilight Zone with my brother, who is going to school for film and television. And it really got me thinking, and I wanted to share some ideas with you and get your thoughts. Okay. Let me say right off the bat that I love The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And fully respect it for what it is and its impact on genre and television history as a whole. So many people in the film and television world have cited as a partial influence on what they do now. That being said, my question is this, and please forgive the blasphemy. Is The Twilight Zone overrated?
Excuse me.
Sorry, you okay there?
I think I just died.
I've recently been watching Alfred Hitchcock Presents on Peacock, because what else is on Peacock? And I
Touché.
Yeah. And I had no idea that this brilliant anthology came first. I always assumed that The Twilight Zone was somewhat like the first of its kind, and that Hitchcock got into the game because of it, and now I find that it existed years before The Twilight Zone. There are also so many great episodes here with great guest stars, writers, and directors, all hosted by the master himself, yet the show is rarely talked about anymore. The same could be said of Tales from the Dark Side, or Tales from the Crypt. Both great, really talked about, or given much credit in the genre as The Twilight Zone. Why do you suppose this is? Tales from the Crypt is an absolute gem, yet rarely do historians or books talk about it. It's always The Twilight Zone this, The Twilight Zone that. The mere fact that I feel guilty for even posing the question shows the power the show yields, yet it wouldn't be the first nor the last of this sort of thing. So why is it the only one we continue to talk about? I'm curious to hear your thoughts, as I know you are fellow horror anthology enthusiasts. Hope to hear from you, Jacob.
That's a great question, and there's a lot of TV history in that. The first part of this was The Twilight Zone unique in its premise and execution? And the answer to that is no.
Yeah.
Before television, when it was first created, the programming was very, very different. A lot of it was live initially, and there were a lot of live sort of plays that were on TV. And as a result, a lot of the TV programming that people saw was essentially in an anthology format. There might be a few television series that were consistent here and there, but there was a lot of variety shows or people just doing various entertainments on TV, or, you know, on Thursday there would be the Captain Crunch Power Hour. And you would see, like, you know, a TV movie that was based on a popular play, or maybe it was adapted from a popular book. The first adaptation of a James Bond movie was a TV movie adaptation of Casino Royale, starring Peter Lorre as the villain Lechiffre. You can find that online, by the way. It's really good. So anthology storytelling wasn't that new. Alfred Hitchcock Presents was a huge hit television series that did predate The Twilight Zone. And a lot of it was based off of the Hitchcockian mold of suspense. There were a lot of adaptations of short stories about people trying to get away with murder and other forms of sort of ghoulish delights. That kind of anthology story, the ones that sort of focus on crime or the supernatural, a lot of that comes from radio.
Yeah.
A lot of that comes from radio. And you would hear a lot of radio. I'm trying to think of like some of them. There was The Whistler. I have a few episodes of The Whistler on an iPod in the car. But yeah, you would hear, listen up every Friday or whatever night it was, and you would hear a new tale of suspense and terror.
There is, I know there's a lot of websites where you can get MP3s of a lot of those old radio shows, and they're actually pretty exhaustively cataloged online, and you can get them for free because they're all in the public domain. And they're great.
A lot of them are great.
There are so many good old-time radio dramas back from the day.
You want just a mountain of free, good storytelling that you can listen to anytime. Look up old radio shows. You're going to run into some racist ones. That's going to happen. But
they were made in the 40s.
Yeah, there's some racism, there's some sexism, there's some other isms that just stink. But not all of them have that, or at least not overtly, and some of them are really fascinating, well-written, excitingly acted. There's some good shit out there.
Look up the Agnes Moorehead rendition of Sorry, Wrong Number. Agnes Moorehead just, like, goes completely insane on mic. She overhears a misconnected telephone call that somebody's plotting a murder.
And she's bedridden, and she can't go anywhere, and so... Yeah, it's just this mountain of suspense. Can she do anything from her bedside with only a telephone and nobody believes her? It's a great story.
And there's a really great Agnes Moorehead audio version of that.
She was one of the great actors, period.
But yeah, a lot of those anthology and a lot of the sort of genre anthology, like the science fiction and the horror, it reaches into radio, but it also reaches into a lot of the pulp novels at the time, which were eventually turned into the comic books at the time, hence the direct line into Tales from the Crypt, which wasn't until the 1980s, but yeah, that was all influencing one another. So yeah, Rod Serling was just taking something that was already pretty popular.
Yeah.
Now, why is it we talk about The Twilight Zone? Well, it's a punchy title, isn't it?
It's a great title.
It's a great, and you know, a lot of the iconic stories were just really well told and really well remembered, and a lot of it has to do with syndication. The Twilight Zone was one of those shows that everybody wanted. It was popular, so we got to see a lot of it in reruns. Not necessarily the same case with something like Alfred Hitchcock Presents. It all had to do with television contracts.
Well, that's a big part of it.
And also, you know, same with Tales from the Crypt. It's really frustrating that HBO, who's, you know, it was HBO Go, HBO Now, HBO Max, they kept on keeping Tales from the Crypt from us for some reason.
Yeah, they still don't have, last I checked, they don't have Tales from the Crypt on HBO Max. Tales from the Crypt was like HBO's signature television series
for
quite a few years.
And I think it was when Oz and The Sopranos came out that they decided to sort of shift gears into like more edgy prestige television.
Yeah, but they still were selling the DVDs. Like they were still proud of it for a while. They had distribution rights. I don't know. Maybe there's something complicated.
And it was a huge hit. Maybe there is some. Maybe it's one of those things because so many different people were involved. It would be difficult to get them all royalties, whatever it is.
I do want to say regarding The Twilight Zone, and I think that's a huge, huge part of it, is just availability. And there's a lot of really, really amazing TV shows, books, music, whatever, that we don't know about and we don't see because it is not readily available, which is another reason why, you know, I think it's important that if a studio has a streaming service, put it all on there. We can't get it otherwise. Like, we can look for it in piracy, but there's no guarantee we'll find it. Like, and a lot of people don't know to look for these things, so they're not going to search piracy to find these things. So put it on on your service, for love of God. So it's definitely part of it. However, there are a few other factors that make The Twilight Zone a significant television series on its own. A big part of it was Rod Serling himself, who, when The Twilight Zone premiered, Rod Serling was considered arguably the great artist in television. He had written a series of TV movies which were award winners, groundbreaking, dealt with serious issues in a way other television wasn't. He did movies like Requiem for a Heavyweight. He did movies like Patterns. These were big deal motion pictures, and he was becoming a household name himself. So Alfred Hitchcock was already Alfred Hitchcock when he did Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Rod Serling was moving into sci-fi. And what was interesting was Alfred Hitchcock kept doing Alfred Hitchcock stuff. Rod Serling was doing hard-hitting serious dramas. And then he moved to sci-fi. Mm. He didn't like graduate from sci-fi to serious dramas, which was what people thought it was. And in fact, there's actually an interview with Rod Serling. I think it was the night Twilight Zone premiered on television, in which he was asked, "Why are you giving up serious storytelling?"
Mm.
And then you watch the Twilight Zone and you realize that he did not.
Yeah.
And in fact, what he was trying to do and what he did more successfully than many other people was he took science fiction and fantasy storytelling, which at the time was popular, but typically seen as something sort
kid
of...
Kid stuff.
Yeah. Kid stuff, culty stuff, you know, guilty pleasure kind of stuff. Mm. And he made hard-hitting, socially relevant, politically conscious science fiction mainstream.
Mm.
And he didn't do it alone. Obviously, he wrote a lot of the episodes himself, but he didn't do it alone. There are a lot of brilliant writers in the Twilight Zone, a lot of brilliant storytellers and directors and actors, but it was his show. He was executive producer, and that show and everyone who collaborated on it has a lot to do with making sci-fi and fantasy more mainstream than it had been before. So I do think that that's significant. Again, he can't give it all the credit. Outer Limits was on like 4 years afterwards and kept that torch going strong. And there's a lot of really, really good shows and movies that were doing something similar. But Twilight Zone was a phenomenon largely for that reason.
Have you watched... we're set to review the Steven Spielberg film The Terminal for our next episode of Critically Acclaimed. Have you watched it yet?
Not yet, no.
There's a scene early on where somebody makes a reference to The Twilight Zone. It's like, you know, The Twilight Zone, like Terror at 30,000 Feet and Talking Tina and the Xanti Misfits, and a security guard standing next door says, "Xanti Misfits was Outer Limits." It's like...
That's cute.
It's really cute.
Yeah. Steven Spielberg himself got his start on an anthology series, Night Gallery.
That's right.
I think that was his first TV gig.
And that was a Rod Serling joint.
Yeah, Rod Serling. After he did The Twilight Zone, he ended up doing another anthology horror-themed series called The Night Gallery, which is not as well-remembered, but a lot of really good episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We keep coming back to The Twilight Zone. I think it's been rebooted 4 or 5 times now. It's never been quite as good as the original.
I've never seen
the 80s
a reboot.
The 80s one is pretty good.
Well, the movie has some highlights.
And the movie has some highlights.
The movie had some real highlights.
Yeah.
Tragic production, but some of the bits came out really good.
The Paramount Plus version, the one that the Jordan Peele did, is awful.
Oh, no. I haven't seen
really,
any of it.
Really
oh,
bad.
That's too bad. That sucks.
Yeah, like they redid Terror at 20,000 Feet, but they changed the premise where a guy's on a plane and it turns out the podcast he's listening to is like predicting what's going to happen 5 minutes from now.
Okay, that's not a bad premise, but that's not Terror from 20,000 Feet.
No, it's completely different, and it ends up going into
I don't mind you putting a twist on an old
stuff.
Put a new twist on it, fine, but don't call it Terror 20,000 Feet. Like, it's kind of rude.
Yeah, they got a lot of like... very famous people to work on it, but it's not a good
version
what
can
of
you
the
do,
Twilight
right?
Zone.
But I guess, there's a lot of... Yeah.
I do maintain that one of the reasons... the reasons a lot of TV shows stay in the popular consciousness is because we have access to them.
Yeah,
I'm wondering if the streaming world, I'm not sure if that's going to help or hinder that, because there's just so much to choose from if things are going to get lost, even
people,
if they are
people
available.
People seem to be going back to the stuff that they already know. Like,
Like,
oh, we'll be able to watch all of The Office. What, again?
Yeah.
Like, what's other shit?
Like, hey, look, Friends. So what? You've seen it, right? And this was a big issue, I remember, in conversations about Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
A lot of the cartoon shorts that people our age were raised on were only the ones that were sort of approved by the studio or like part of this little small selection of the broad Termite Terrace catalog.
Well, relatively small. There was still a lot of them, but like there was a lot that we weren't seeing.
It's like we saw about 75 to 100 of them, but there were hundreds to choose from.
Yeah.
So as such, we got to know Chuck Jones really, really well.
Yeah.
And that's fine because Chuck Jones' shorts are brilliant.
He's a genius,
But we didn't see Bob Clampett as much.
Yeah.
A lot of the later Friz Freleng stuff was kept out of the loop. And a lot of it had to do with TV contracts. And that's what we ended up talking about.
And you and I are both, and this is one of the things I love about working with you, is that you and I are both really big on, we talk about everything that's mainstream because people are talking about it. It's hitting a lot of audiences, and it's important to speak about popular things critically because it's having the largest, widest impact. However, a really important job of any critic, any art critic, is to shed light on things that aren't getting noticed, or worse, are getting lost to history. So you and I are big proponents of digging things up that no one else gives a crap about. and the hopes that maybe they're good. And some we've discovered a lot of things, especially on our show Canceled Too Soon, where we focus on TV shows that failed, some of which are popular enough to have a cult, but most of which are not. And we're looking at that to see if it's worth checking out. Because I know I hear a lot of people like, oh, I don't want to see this TV show that failed. And I'm like, because like yeah, I want to get super invested in it. I'm like, but you're missing something really cool. And some of them have a perfectly good ending. Yeah. Some of them don't like end on a cliffhanger. Like a lot of them don't. Like they're perfectly fine. So in any case, I'm big on that. But in any case, yeah, Twilight Zone, a lot of it is syndication. It genuinely was a very good show. There's a couple of duds in there. No one's pretending otherwise. But like... but it has a bit more cultural significance than I think it's something people remember. I did a lot of research on The Twilight Zone. It was my favorite show growing up. All right. I think we have time for one more.
All right. Here's a letter from RJ.
Hi, RJ.
Hello, Biz and Whitney. Hope you're well. I wanted to talk to you about your review of If Anything Happens, I Love You. And more specifically, how you watched it. That was one of the Oscar-nominated animated shorts.
Yes. And you and I both did not care for it. It's a very intensely emotional short. And you and I both thought it handled its subject matter rather inelegantly.
Yeah, I think I used the term cheap shot.
We didn't care for it.
Yeah. I personally loved the film and did consider it one of 2020's best. And whilst I can see where you guys are coming from in certain areas, there's one thing I can't quite wrap my head around.
Okay.
This is partly because I spaced out for a second and thought you guys were still talking about Genius Loci, which is another one of the shorts. But the part I didn't understand is where Bibbs referred to the emotional climax of the film as a twist. For the sake of consistency for listeners, I won't say what it refers to. However, I would like to discuss your interpretation of that as a twist. For the next few weeks or so before this film came out in November, I knew exactly what the film was about from articles and social media. And even if I hadn't, the opening line of the synopsis on Netflix UK explicitly states what happens. Of course, I can't vouch for what happens on US Netflix.
Right.
So as far as I understood, this aspect of the film was common knowledge and not a spoiler at all. And on both times watching it, I rewatched it shortly after a review, I can't for the life of me see how it functions as a twist. So what I wanted to ask was, did you know anything about this movie before you saw it? Did you watch it on Netflix or was it a screener? Because the only way I can make sense of it is if you went into it blind, but I don't want to assume that and just thought I would ask. To be clear, I don't think your criticisms are invalid at all. I see what you mean, but personally, I don't think it feels sensationalist in the slightest. I actually think it's done very naturally, feeling haunting and sobering, helped by the knowledge that the filmmakers had spoken to several parents who had been through this and consulted a charity dedicated to this sort of thing. Whether you did or didn't know, it made me think about how our expectations shape the way we experience certain films.
Yeah.
Bibbs has often talked about trying not to anticipate films so he can remain indifferent. I've heard a lot of people who prefer to know just a single thing about a film before they watch it. On paper, the latter theory seems like a good way to approach films, but sometimes I think it can lead to a misunderstanding of what a film actually is or is trying to do, and it can throw you off if you're not prepared at least a little bit for what it's going to give you. So when I watched If Anything Happens, I Love You, a sense of dread I had throughout found it a lot easier to immerse myself in the emotion of the piece. I'm wondering now if you had felt the same way you did if you had known it. What is your take on that? Thank you for your content. Love you both. Sincerely, RJ.
RJ, thank you so much. And again, we're happy you enjoyed the film. And you actually bring up some really exciting points about how storytelling works and how the information that we bring into... any work of art affects that work of art. Marshall McLuhan has written about this really elegantly in a lot of his works, about how if you watch or witness a work of art in a vacuum, your experience will be dramatically different. One of the examples he used was, here is a painting here's a painting by Claude Monet. And then he'll show you the same painting. Here's the last painting Claude Monet did before he died.
Oh, no, it was Van Gogh.
It was Van Gogh. Yeah. Okay, but regardless, similar premise.
Yeah.
Right? It's like one, all of a sudden, the thing feels more dramatically important rather than just, here's a painting, and here's the last thing someone painted before they died. All of a sudden, you're looking for a little bit more meaning, aren't you? It's innate. You can't help but be a little tainted by that. Not tainted, tinted. What you're aware of going into something absolutely affects how you're going to view it. If you know the ending going in, you're going to be waiting for that ending. I know about me. I don't know about Whitney. I actually did go into this short film blind. Did you know anything about this short going
not,
into
not a thing. Okay. And indeed, that's my philosophy as a filmmaker.
As a film critic.
Or filmmaker. Film critic.
It's 12:24 in the morning.
I say it a lot. That's my philosophy as a film critic. I try to go in as blind as possible. Some, like, bigger blockbusters that are advertised to death and, like, we have to write about.
There are billboards everywhere. Yeah, it's impossible to go
in. It's hard to go in totally blind. Also, I don't get to experience it anymore, but I used to very much value the preview experience, going to a theater and seeing all of the coming attractions. It was actually a very exciting part of going to the movies, and that's something that I have completely missed out on as a critic. When you go to a film screen, a press screening, they don't show you previews.
Yeah, I've seen it like once. They've ever shown a preview.
Sometimes they, like, and really, really rarely, they'll attach one because that's the way it's going to be released theatrically.
Yeah,
like, it's attached to the head of the movie.
Yeah. But 99% of the time, they don't do that.
Yeah. And I think this philosophy allows me, as a critic, to watch films on their terms.
Yeah.
If an advertising campaign or an anticipation machine or even a simple single paragraph blurb is needed to make sure I have enough context to appreciate that film differently, then I think the film isn't doing it, all of its own heavy lifting.
No, the film isn't providing the context, because you can't guarantee that anyone watching a movie or reading a book or whatever, but just for the sake of Robin, we'll stick with movies. You can't guarantee that every single human being that watches a movie will have done the supplemental reading.
Exactly.
Will have seen the trailer, will have read the blurb. You can't guarantee that. And as a result, it behooves art critics to focus on the experience that will be universal. Now, again, you can't always do that. Sometimes you have seen the trailer. Sometimes you happen to have read the book it's based on in advance. You can't control that. Mm-hmm. But it is something that we try to focus on. And when you witness a film without knowing anything about it going in, you'll see that the way films are constructed to reveal information is very deliberate. Now, sometimes movies are very straightforward, just a sequence of events, no twists. In the case of If Anything Happens, I Love You, I'm not going to ruin the movie, but I'm going to just try to guide you through the structure here. We see a married couple, and they're incredibly sad, and they're incredibly angry, but they're not talking to each other.
And there's no dialogue in the piece.
None. They're incredibly sad, they're not talking to each other, and it quickly becomes clear that they are grieving. The way that the movie parcels out information, first you know they're grieving, then you realize who they're grieving for, then you realize why they're grieving. Mm. And the why is an incredibly dramatic kick in the pants. Whether you find that effective or not, that's a matter of taste. But you're not supposed to know the why at the beginning of the story unless you've read the blurb, but again, there's no guarantee you will have. So if you haven't, get any experience. Let me put this in another context. Let me give this a movie that everyone knows, or a lot of people know. Terminator 2 Judgment Day. If you've seen the trailer for it, if you know the gist of it, if you've seen it before, we all know that it's the story of Terminator, but instead of a human going back in time to save someone from a killer robot, this is about a killer robot who goes back in time to save someone from another killer robot. And the hero killer robot looks just like the bad guy in the first movie. He's played by Arnold Schwarzenegger. That was the premise. A lot of the trailers gave that away. The movie is structured as though you don't know that.
Yeah.
And you can tell because it's pretty...
The moment when that's revealed is a big reveal.
It's a big reveal. Yeah. They both go back in time. We see the Terminator go back in time, beat the crap out of people. It's no evidence that it's not an evil Terminator. Robert Patrick, the actual evil Terminator, goes back in time. We see him beat up a guy, but we don't explicitly see him kill anybody. And there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that he's the villain until both Terminators, and we don't know Robert Patrick is a Terminator yet, are at opposite ends of a hallway, and John Connor
is caught in between both of them.
And he looks behind him, and he sees the Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator, and he realizes that everything his mother told him is true, and that this Terminator is out to kill him. both Robert Patrick and Arnold Schwarzenegger raise their guns, mm-hmm. and then, this is the big moment, Arnold Schwarzenegger tells John Connor to get down, uh-huh. because he's there to save him. That's built up as this amazing, dramatic reveal. Oh my God, the bad guy is the good guy this time? Holy crap! That's amazing! Imagine if you'd had a chance to experience that without seeing the trailer. Because if you have seen the trailer, it's kind of a lot of build-up for something we already know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it a letdown because they don't spend too much time. It's not like you're waiting the whole movie, like in Terminator Genesis, where they gave away like who the bad guy was and you have to wait half the movie for the movie to catch up. But that's an issue.
And it's getting more complicated as well because it's not just a matter of a single blurb or a preview. Now it's all reliant on what we know from press releases.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee you that a lot of those Avengers films wouldn't be big hits if we didn't know if there was a next one or what the next one was going to be. A lot of people are anticipating what the next one is going to be. A lot of people know what the next four or five are going to be in order.
Yeah, there's a general sense that, even if I'm not super interested in the superhero, I need to see the next Ant-Man because it's going to tie into Doctor Strange
It's an episode and a bigger thing, and we know what the episodes are. So now this whole anticipation complex is, and we're not really, well, I don't want to say we're not looking at them as individual films, but a lot of people aren't. A lot of people are seeing them as a small cog in a bigger super narrative.
Which they are.
Yeah.
Which, undeniably, I think they are.
And that's a way to make movies, whether or not that's brilliant or anathema to cinema is a matter of debate.
it can be both.
It can be both simultaneously.
It can be absolutely brilliant and also maybe not a good thing overall. It can be both.
When it comes to that specific short, though, I do think that the way it's presented me, without any kind of context, I did feel like it was a cheap shot. It felt like a cheap shot. It felt like far too sudden, dramatic, and violent a thing that to lay in place with the tone of the rest of the thing, which was actually very kind of sweet and sentimental. And
and then the shock value just really jarring
and it felt really cheap.
I'm sure every single person making that movie, maybe not everyone, but I'm sure theoretically every single person making that movie meant the absolute best and they were trying to tell a story, but like, you can illuminate this thing without making the reason why we're there some kind of big reveal. And again, if they expect everybody to know, I don't think that's a wise decision creatively. We can have that conversation if you want, but I don't think it is. But this is one of the reasons why I have, of late, in the last 5 years or so, tried to really look at the way that we disseminate information about movies and media before we see it. In particular, and not just information, but the level of excitement and the level of foreknowledge that we start taking for granted. And we've seen this bite people in the butt a couple of times. Like, oh yeah, well, I've listened to all of these fan theories and I know exactly what's going to happen in the next Star Wars. And then if that doesn't happen, I mean, it's possible that it could be so awesome that you just love it, but you had the movie in your head, and now all of a sudden here's something else, and the movie in your head will never exist.
Yeah.
Whether you're still capable of enjoying the movie or not is another matter, but that's bound to impact the way you process the movie you get. And I think what we should try to do is we should try to be as open-minded to whatever we get and appreciate the movie for what it is. Not what it was advertised as. Not what the podcast that we listened to suggested it might be. Just whatever the hell it is. And that way, if it defies our expectations in a good or a bad way, we can acknowledge that and we can talk about that. And we can get excited for it if it's amazing. We can talk about it if it sucks. But I think that's super important. And again, you can't always go into something without any foreknowledge. But I do recommend trying it if you can. I know foreknowledge is fun. I like previews. Previews are fun. Previews aren't art form in and of themselves, but sometimes I'm better off not knowing.
I did an experiment with myself once back when I was well, I mean, I'm still obsessed with Star Trek The Next Generation, but back when it was, like, happening live.
Yeah.
This was, why, you know, in the era of VCRs, and I would tape the episodes, and I would watch it more than once before the next episode would air the following week. Yeah. I was just because I wanted to enjoy it. I wanted to get to know the show really, really well. And I would always pay attention to the bumpers, like, what's coming next? All the ads that would come up throughout the week on TV. Yeah. Leading
next
up to the
next generation.
Star Trek, The Next Generation, Wesley will die, you know, whatever, yeah. whatever they got. And they pulled that crap multiple times. One member of the crew will die. And then it's like some technical thing, like a hologram of them is shot.
Yeah, it's always crap. Or this episode, Mulder and Scully will kiss in a dream.
They'll kiss other people. Well, yeah.
But it was in the past on the Titanic, and it didn't really happen.
But I did an experiment for myself on myself once where whenever I saw a bumper start to come up, I would like mute the television and close my eyes and deliberately not watch.
Yeah.
Like I wanted to know nothing about what was coming up. And you know what? I found it to be a much more satisfying experience. Yeah. My anticipation was a little different. I couldn't get excited about scenes I knew were coming. But I felt a little bit more engaged with the show on a story level, which was a little bit different. I could like appreciate the writing a little bit differently.
Yeah, you could appreciate, because again, people they don't know when we're writing a story, when they're writing a script for a movie, TV show, whatever. They don't know what's going to be in the trailer.
Yeah,
they can guess, but they don't know. Mm. There's something I've written about this. I think that article has now been stricken from the internet because that's how the internet works. But I called it the Genesis effect after Terminator Genesis, where you write a story that is so predicated on a twist that maybe you should have predicted that a trailer is going to have to give it away because otherwise there's nothing to talk about in a trailer. And as a result, you might run the risk of having the movie pre-spoiled, even though you've written the movie out as though these are going to be big surprises. That's a serious danger. But generally speaking, they don't know what scenes are going to show up in the trailer. They don't know what line of dialogue is going to show up in the trailer. And the people putting together a trailer or a promo for a future episode, they can completely lie to you. They can tell you that this character will die or whatever like that, and that they won't. They're not doing that. They're just not making it seem as exciting as possible. Like, what was I just watching? I was watching something... I was watching some preview. Oh, I was watching a preview of Sherlock Holmes, the Robert Downey Jr. movie, because we were doing a podcast about the various Sherlock versions. And they had re-edited the trailer for the first Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes story to suggest that two completely different scenes between Robert Downey Jr. and Rachel McAdams were happening at the same time in such a way that suggested that Robert Downey Jr. was like watching her undress or something. And it's like, that's not in the movie. That's not a thing, but they edited the trailer to suggest that it was because it made it seem more salacious and therefore might make people want to see it more. But if you're expecting that, you're not going to find that. So in any case, you can't, the other problem with that I will say this before we wrap things up. Your experiment you did with Next Generation presupposes an interest in watching the show.
Yeah.
And that's the trick, is the reason why we have promos, previews, press releases, blurbs on Netflix is if you know nothing about it, it's supposed to get you interested until you know why to watch it. And that's a tricky line. And sometimes they give away too much and end up hurting the story, revealing surprises are not supposed to be revealed, telling the story in a way that the storytellers didn't originally want it to be in their intention. But on some level, you do need to find out about something. You can't just randomly click stuff all the time. We're human. We want to follow, you know, our interests and our passions. Yeah. So that's a lot of that's word of mouth. A lot of that's podcasts or whatever, but it's imperfect. You can't do it perfectly, but it's a pursuit. It's an ideal. You can't always live up to your ideals, but the point is you try. So for me, I try to go in with knowing as little as I can most of the time.
Yeah, it's actually kind of embarrassing when I'm talking to my wife. It's like, I have to review X films for this week.
Yeah.
And she'll ask me, what's that one about? And I just have to sort of sheepishly say, I don't know. I haven't looked into like the actual story.
I have a title,
running time, and country of origin. And that's kind of like all I got a lot of the time. Yeah. So it's, I just have to kind of find out as I go. And,
yeah. and then we'll tell you.
I think that's healthy, but that's also like a really uninteresting way to have a conversation about movies with people who watch previews and know that kind of thing going in to see a film.
Anyway, nothing's perfect, but this is what we've boiled down to. So anyway, that is it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you so much. Really awesome letters this week.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there always are, but like, this is a really interesting, you know, array of hard-hitting topics, and I loved it. So thank you so much to everybody who wrote in. We think you're amazing. Mm. If you want to write in for a future episode, we don't have time to get to all our letters because, as you may have noticed, we're talkers. It's a good thing, too. We have podcasts. Got to fill the air sometime. You can write into letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. That's the email address, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We would love to hear from you. Please write in. If you don't want to write in a whole letter, you're more than welcome to tweet us. We are at Critic Acclaim. On Twitter, I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you want more critically acclaimed shows, we have a lot over there. We have shows dedicated to every single episode of Star Trek ever made. Mm-hmm. We have shows dedicated to every episode of the 1960s Batman. We have commentary tracks. Mm. We have shows dedicated to every film ever nominated for Best Picture. We have films dedicated to movies that should be on Disney Plus but mysteriously are not. We have polls to help you decide future episodes of various programs on the critically acclaimed network, and other things as well. So head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork if you can afford to help out the show. We really would appreciate it. If you can't afford to help out the show, we totally get it.
You're under no obligation.
No obligation.
We're grateful, but we don't want to make anybody's situation worse.
No, we don't have a lot of money either. We totally get it. If you want to help out the show and you can't afford to join the Patreon, there's a lot of different ways you can. Leave us a review wherever you find us. A star rating, write down a couple of sentences. That really helps us get higher up in algorithms and show up in more searches. So that really, really helps. Talk about us online and various social medias. People are asking for podcasts or things. Let them know. That would really help us out a lot too. That would be nice. and of course, if you're writing a review, be honest. We don't want you to just, you know, say nice things if you don't believe it. Like, leave any review. Just, we believe in honesty in our criticism. We hope you do too. And a fish.
And a fish too.
I don't know. It'd be nice. Oh, and we have soap. If you go to Etsy.com, and you search for Salt Cat Soap, all one word, you're going to find a lot of handcrafted, unique soaps that were designed mostly by my wife and partner, M. Lapis de Silva, but also a few that were designed by me. And they are really fancy. They make great gifts. Mother's Day and Father's Day are coming up. Just a suggestion there. the reviews have been really, really great so far. And we really appreciate it. So thank you, everybody who already purchased some. We drop new designs on the first Saturday of every month. Sometimes some surprises in the middle of the month as well. And, of course, M. Lapis de Silva has a novel that is still available. It's called Hooker. It is a pro-sex work, pro-queer, feminist retrowave vigilante slasher hybrid. It is about a sex worker who fights a misogynistic serial killer in 1980s Los Angeles, and she uses hooks as weapons. And it's awesome. And I do hope you check it out. It's available on Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble. It's a cool book. Anyway, that's it.
That's it. Thank you for listening.
Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.